thanks to the intercepted calls, which were cross-checked against covert deep observation carried out by Sayeret troops and information from Mossad agents. The saltfish teams had an abundance of information on the hideouts used by Arafat. Still, it was a very complicated mission, said Diane. We had to collate the information from the various sources to understand which building or cave was the right one, to pinpoint it on the map, to narrow it down to 10-figure coordinates, to transmit them to the Air Force, giving them enough time to put a plane in the air and bomb it. The long days and nights at the Saltfish command post were mostly frustrating times, as Arafat escaped time and again. Langotsky and Diane would hear the bodyguards arranging Arafat's arrival at a certain place and time, and quickly give the Air Force the coordinates. Once they even heard Arafat himself on the phone, and sent in a pair of fighter bombers that razed the building. But Arafat had left not more than 30 seconds earlier, according to Dan. The Palestinian leader understood that it was not a coincidence that bombs were repeatedly falling at places he had just entered or just left. He told his people that Sharon, in Beirut, was acting like a wounded wolf and wanted to kill him in revenge for the way the war was dragging on. He began taking more precautionary measures, arranging several meetings at the same time in different places. He scattered disinformation around among his aides, suspicious that one of them might be a Mossad agent, and he moved around all the time. Arafat kept on breaking his routine, said Moshe Ya'alon, a Saltfish officer. There was no regular pattern in his behavior, nothing that could enable the preparation of a raid by land against a bunker or a house. The team, growing increasingly desperate, came up with innumerable ideas. On July 3, the left-wing Israeli magazine editor Yuri Avneri crossed the front line in Beirut to interview Arafat, together with reporter Sarit Ishai and photographer Anat Saragusti, in the heart of the city. The meeting was highly controversial in Israel. Arafat was seen as the country's worst enemy, and this was his first time meeting an Israeli. My goal was to begin paving a path to Israeli-Palestinian peace by changing the Israelis' way of thinking, Avneri said. The Saltfish team didn't particularly admire this initiative. I won't even begin to say what I think about Avneri and his outrageous act, said Ya'alon, but decided to take advantage of the opportunity to track the three Israelis and to let them lead a group of assassins straight to Arafat. Among the Saltfish team members, a discussion took place over whether it was permissible to endanger the lives of the Israelis or perhaps even kill them, while carrying out their mission. Avner Azulai, the Mossad representative in the Saltfish Forum, summed up the outcome of this debate. If the conditions were right from the operational aspect, it is reasonable to assume that both Arafat and these three dear Jews would not have remained alive. But the ever-cautious Arafat suspected that the Mossad might be keeping tabs on Avneri and the two journalists with him. Arafat's security guards took strict deceptive countermeasures, and the Saltfish team lost their trail in the alleys of South Beirut. As more days went by, and the reality of a messy, fomented civil war refused to conform to Sharon and Eitan's wildly overambitious plan to restructure an entire region of the planet, the two hawks put increasing pressure on the Air Force and the Saltfish teams to get Arafat. From the start of the siege of Beirut, the matter of killing Arafat assumed huge importance. The feeling was that it was something personal for Sharon, said Major General David Ivry, then an Air Force commander. Every now and again, people from the Mossad or Amman would show up at Canary, the Air Force command post, in a subterranean bunker deep beneath Tel Aviv, and tell us that Arafat was here or there. Sharon or Raful would order us to bomb those places immediately. I thought that it was messy, with the danger of harming civilians, Ivry continued. I was not ready to okay a bombing party like that without getting an order in writing from the General Staff's operations branch. I hoped that placing the matter into an organized framework of information sharing and decision-making would lead to better judgment. In fact, many of the orders never came in writing. They just disappeared somewhere on the way. Uzi Dayan had the same misgivings. Arafat was saved by two things, he said. His interminable good luck and me. I thought Arafat was a legitimate target, but I did not think that hitting the target justified any means. If I saw that it entailed large-scale killing of civilians, even if we knew Arafat was there, I did not agree to have a place bombed. Raful used to blow up with anger, Diane continued. He'd call me up and say, I understand you have information on such and such a place. Why aren't the planes in the air? I replied that it was impossible because there were a lot of people around. Raful said, forget about it. I'll take responsibility for it. I wasn't prepared to allow it. Raful would not teach me the ethics of war. Rafael Eitan would remind Diane that he was not authorized to decide whether to drop a bomb, but as Diane explained, all I had to do was to report when the target was ripe from the intelligence point of view. So from that point on, each time we knew that bombing would lead to massive civilian casualties, we reported that the target wasn't ripe from the intelligence angle. On the evening of August 4, Eitan asked the head of the Air Force Operations Department, Aviem Sela, to come and see him. The two had a close relationship, and Eitan had a soft spot for Sela, a highly promising officer considered a potential commander of the Air Force. Eitan greeted Sela and told him that the next day he wouldn't be working in Canary as usual, but would be going on a trip. Anything like our last trip together? Asked Sela, alluding to a visit to Beirut in May, in preparation for the invasion and the operation to assassinate Arafat. Something like it. Eitan replied, but from above. Meet me tomorrow morning at Hatzor, an Air Force base in the south. You'll fly the plane, and I'll navigate and operate the combat systems. We're going to bomb Beirut. The target was a building where Arafat was supposed to be the next morning, according to information obtained by Operation Saltfish. Sela knew that Eitan had a pilot's license for light aircraft, but he still was convinced he wasn't hearing right. It was totally insane, he said. I was in shock. If someone had told me that the chief of staff, who isn't really an airman, was taking the head of the Air Force Operations Department for a break in the running of the war while they bombed Beirut for fun, I would never have believed it. But Chief of Staff Eitan was obsessive about killing Arafat. The next day, the two met at Hatzor. They were part of a quartet of phantoms on an expedition to bomb the Al-Sana'i office block in West Beirut, where Arafat was supposed to be attending a meeting. Raful's functioning was so-so. I think he was feeling a little bit sick. I did my own navigation. He operated the munition systems, which by today's terms were rather primitive. We made two bombing runs over the target, and then another one to see if we'd hit it. Raful was happy, and we flew home to Israel. Arafat was once again saved by a miracle. The bombs wrecked part of the building just before he arrived. Sela returned from Hatzor to Tel Aviv to manage the operations of the Air Force, and Eitan took a helicopter ride to Beirut. In the evening, Sela recalls, I saw him on TV, being interviewed on the outskirts of Beirut. He declared that Israel was refraining from bombing targets in civilian surroundings, which was exactly what he had been doing himself that morning. The problem with Operation Saltfish for Sharon and for Israel was that the entire world was watching. With each failed assassination attempt, Israel looked more and more like a military power overrunning a sovereign nation in a monomaniacal quest to kill a single man. Arafat, rather than being seen as a bloodthirsty terrorist, was now the hunted leader of a nation of refugees trampled by the Israeli war machine. Sharon had achieved precisely the opposite of what he wanted. Its main target now an object of global sympathy, the invasion sank deeper into a swamp of military misadventure. The stalemate had to be broken, a quasi-victory salvaged. On August 1, the IDF began exerting heavy pressure on the PLO forces in Beirut, Operation King Kong, with an unbroken 72-hour artillery bombardment aimed at persuading Arafat to withdraw from Lebanon. The Israeli Air Force carried out more than 100 expeditions in a 10-hour period. The barrage from the air, land, and sea continued after that as well, and reached a climax on August 12, which became known as Black Thursday, because of the vast devastation wrought. The pressure worked. On August 13, with the Americans mediating, Arafat agreed to evacuate Beirut with his forces. Uzi Dayan departed the city and left the saltfish team under Ya'alon's command, with mixed feelings. I didn't spend the rest of my life mourning, but I thought then, and I still believe today, that it's a pity the mission was not executed, he said. On the other hand, the war was a very distressing affair from a humanitarian point of view. We watched the Lebanese population around us, the poverty, the destruction caused by the fighting. Among us, among the fighting forces, there was a great argument. I knew friends, comrades in arms who really believed that someone should go and kill Sharon, who actually contemplated assassinating him to save the state of Israel. I had supported the war from the outset, but I also understood that there was deadlock, that the war wasn't going anywhere. Sharon and Raful were deceiving everyone. I left Beirut with a feeling of great relief. On August 21, the PLO forces evacuated Beirut by sea. Israel's relationship with the United States was very tense, considering the invasion of Lebanon and the siege of Beirut. Prime Minister Begin was eager to calm things down. When the evacuation agreement was signed, he promised the American mediator, Philip Habib, that no harm would be inflicted on the evacuees. Keeping this promise was important to Begin, and he firmly instructed Sharon to drop any plans that had been made to exploit the withdrawal as a way to settle scores with Arafat. The saltfish team remained in Beirut and on August 30 took up positions, together with Shin Bet and Mossad officers, on the adjacent roofs of the Lebanese National Oil and Power Companies, overlooking the port. From a distance we saw a large convoy of vehicles, one of the Shin Bet operatives remembers. All of a sudden, we saw the famous kifaya on the famous head of the number one wanted man coming out of one of the cars. He stood among a crowd of people, as if surrounded by a swarm of bees. It would have been so easy to kill him. We were 180 meters away, Ya'alon said. At that range, with the sniper rifle that our team was holding, it's hard to miss. Others who were there remember that Arafat was in the sights of at least five snipers at the same time. One of the commanders was in radio contact with Chief of Staff Eitan in the command bunker in Tel Aviv, updating him on when Arafat would be out of range. We can do it. We have him in our sights. Do we have authorization? Eitan delayed, and the officer continued. He's about to go inside in 10, 9 seconds. Please give us authorization. 8, 7. Finally, Eitan replied in his nasal voice, audibly disappointed. Negative, he said. I repeat, negative. There is no authorization. 24 hours later, Begin gave Habib a picture of Arafat and the crosshairs of a sniper's rifle to prove that, despite the opportunity, Israel had stood by its word. By then Arafat was already in Athens, en route to the PLO's next stop in Tunis. Begin's goal to wipe out Hitler in his bunker, as he had declared to Reagan, had become watching Hitler get airlifted out of Berlin. Chapter 16. Black Flag. Sharon had promised to withdraw the IDF from Lebanon as soon as the PLO departed, but he instead remained fixated on his grand plan of remaking the Middle East. With Israeli forces firmly entrenched and the Mossad exerting heavy pressure, the Lebanese parliament voted on August 23, 1982, to install the Falange leader, Bashir Gemayel, as president. In Sharon's fantasy, Gemayel would expel the Palestinians from Lebanon. More immediately, Sharon wanted to knock out what he called the terror nucleus, PLO militiamen, and the left-wing forces, communist and other leftist groups allied with the PLO, which are armed with heavy weaponry and remain in West Beirut. Sharon knew that the United Nations would soon deploy a multinational peacekeeping force, MNF, in Beirut, and once that happened, he would no longer be able to do what he wished. At a meeting with the heads of the Mossad and the Shin Bet, he wondered aloud, How will we be able to take care of the terrorists when the MNF is active? These would be entirely different methods. We'll have to be certain that the problem has been solved, with every step we take today making things easier then. Sharon didn't want to put the IDF into the heart of the Palestinian refugee camps, so he suggested that the Falangists go into West Beirut to ensure that whoever from the PLO was there would be killed or arrested. Begin liked this idea and approved of giving the job to the Falange because our boys won't spill their blood on this matter. The Mossad embellished this proposition. We had a long list of names of European leftist activists who were with the Palestinians, said Avner Azoulay, the Mossad's liaison with the Maronite militia. The idea was to hand it to the Falangists so they could find them and kill them. After that, the Mossad would be able to secretly report to the European countries from which these bandits came, such as Germany, France, and Italy, that their problem was solved. And this way, they would owe us a favor. As it happened, Jamal was instead murdered 3 weeks later, together with a large number of his associates, blown up by a bomb planted by a Syrian agent that demolished the Falange headquarters in Beirut. In response, the Lebanese Christian militias secured permission from the Israelis to search for PLO fighters in the Palestinian refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila. On the morning of September 16, Yair Ravid, the head of the junction team in Beirut, was at the Falange headquarters, where the Mossad had placed its Beirut station. All of a sudden, Ravid said, I saw the boys of Eli, Hobeka, the Falange military chief, sharpening their knives. And they tell me, today it is the turn of Sila al-Abyad, the white weapons, which is what the Lebanese call slaughtering with knives. They didn't say against whom exactly, but it was clear to me they were going to cut throats. I didn't inquire any deeper. I was just a guest of theirs. Ravid didn't report to his superiors what he'd seen. Robert Hatem, Obeka's executioner, recalled that when the 350 Falangists set out on their mission, Obeka told us, fuck everybody there. Erase the camp. We even took a D9 bulldozer to demolish everything. The camp, Hatem said, was made up of shacks, tin shanties. When we fired, everything came tumbling down. We shot in all directions. We didn't check to see who was behind those walls. The lion's share of the damage was inflicted by a group commanded by Marom Mashalani. Its members, Hatem said, including the commander, took a lot of drugs, as much as it is possible to take. They didn't distinguish between fighters and non-combatants or between men and women. They shot them all. The result was a horrific massacre. The number of the dead is disputed. The Israelis say 700, and the Palestinians say 2,750. Sharon would later claim that Lebanese forces, i.e. the Falangists, would conform to the conventions of war when the IDF was controlling them, overseeing or coordinating their actions. The terrible outcome is in the nature of an unanticipated and unexplained breakdown. In other words, Sharon argued that he could not have foreseen what had happened. Classified IDF and Mossad documents, however, prove that the barbaric behavior pattern of the Falange had long been known by the heads of the Israeli defense establishment. The prevalent assumption was that, straight after the evacuation of the PLO from Beirut, the Falange would find a way to move in to settle scores. That murder would begin in Beirut from the first day. Sharon himself had spoken with contempt about any possible military contribution the Falange could make, asserting, forget about them, they won't do a thing. Maybe later when it'll be possible to loot, to kill, to rape. Yes, then they will rape and loot and kill. The IDF and the Mossad didn't contribute directly to the massacre, but the patronage they extended to the Christian forces and their failure to protect the occupied Palestinians tarred Israel's name. As soon as the Israelis discovered what the Falangists had done, they ordered them to cease and expressed their outrage. At the same time, however, they also began counseling the Maronite militia on what to tell the legions of journalists now covering the atrocity. fierce international and domestic censure followed. The leaders of the opposition, Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres, withdrew their support for the war when they became aware of the scale of the killing. Sharon's response was typical. Testifying behind closed doors before a 1982 Knesset oversight panel on the Secret Services, he read from a sheaf of classified documents about the massacre of Palestinians perpetrated by the Maronites at the Tel al-Za'atar refugee camp in 1976, when Rabin and Peres were running the country. Sharon dwelled at length on the horrendous slaughter of children, the blades that slashed open pregnant women's bellies. Peres responded angrily, "Who knew what was going on?" Sharon replied, "The Red Cross reported that during those days of the massacre, our ships prevented the entry of vessels carrying medical aid. You built the relationship, and we continued it. You also helped them after the massacre. We didn't complain to you then. And I would not have raised the matter if you did not behave the way you behaved. You, Mr. Peres, after Tel al-Za'atar, have no monopoly on morality." Sharon's menacing tone was clear. One of his aides hinted to the heads of the Labor Party that if they pushed for an official inquiry into the Sabra and Shatila massacre, these classified documents about their actions during the Tel al-Za'atar massacre would be leaked to international media as well. The criticism from the Labor Party duly died down. Public protests, however, were still ramping up as the official count of Israeli troops killed in Lebanon rose every day. Demonstrations were held outside the Prime Minister's residence, with protesters shouting slogans and carrying placards condemning Begin and Sharon. Every day, the protesters updated a giant sign facing Begin's residence that counted the number of dead soldiers from Sharon's misbegotten war. Sharon seems to have been indifferent to the protests. But Begin was ailing. He sank deeper and deeper into what became a clinical depression, gradually losing the ability and desire to communicate with those around him, cutting himself off almost entirely from the apparatus of governance. "I watched Begin withering away, shrinking into himself," said Nivo. He realized that Sharon had hoodwinked him, that he had entered a swamp that he had not wanted to enter. The victims and the protests were killing him. The man was a very sensitive person, perhaps too sensitive. His condition deteriorated so much that his aides refrained from reporting bad news to him, out of fear that he would slip over the edge. "I also saw him during his period of decline," said Nahum Admoni, who became Mossad chief in September 1982. "I begin a briefing, and after a few minutes, I see his eyes are shut, and I don't know whether he's listening to what I'm saying, whether he's asleep or awake. A very embarrassing situation, very embarrassing. I ask Azriel Nivo, his military aide, do you think I should go on talking or stop?" We didn't refer the problem to anyone else, but everyone knew. Everyone knew this was the situation. And yet, though nearly everyone around Begin knew he was hardly functioning, let alone fit to run a country at war, instead of moving to replace him, they decided to cover for him, and his aides worked to conceal his true condition from the Israeli public. The secretaries in his bureau went on typing out the Prime Minister's schedule every day, but it was empty. And so, to conceal it, I told them to classify the schedule top secret so that no one could see it, said Nivo, adding that he believed that he and the other bureau staff were criminals, and we perpetrated a grave offense. You can't hide the fact that the Prime Minister is actually not functioning, and acting as if he is. It calls to mind benighted regimes. With Begin all but absent, Sharon was now free to do what he wished with the military. During this whole period, in fact, Sharon was effectively running the country, unconstitutionally and without any restraints. He even took charge of the Mossad, although it formally came under the Prime Minister's jurisdiction. He was practically commander-in-chief of the military, giving orders over Chief of Staff Eitan's head, recalled Aviem Sela, head of Air Force operations. No one could stand up to him. Sharon dominated the meetings of the cabinet, Admoni said. He never gave an accurate or full picture either at cabinet plenums or at sessions of the inner cabinet, which was supposed to decide defense issues. There were also times when Sharon would introduce a subject, the cabinet would discuss it, make a decision, and Sharon would call us out after the meeting, the chief of staff Eitan, me, the other officers, and say, "They decided what they decided. Now I'm telling you to do this or that," which was not exactly what they had decided. With his well-deserved but also carefully cultivated image of a George Patton-like war hero, and his freedom from doubts or misgivings about getting what he wanted on a personal or national level, Sharon was known in Israel as the bulldozer. Cynical and ruthless, sometimes menacing, but more often charming and congenial, he had no qualms about twisting the truth when he deemed it necessary. "Arik, King of Israel," his supporters used to sing about him. And during this time, he did obtain almost monarchical rule. Yet despite his newly amassed power, Sharon was also a realist, and he quickly grasped after the death of Bashir Gemayel that his aspirations for Lebanon were not to be. Amin Gemayel, who was elected president instead of his brother Bashir, was far less connected and committed to Israel, and after a short time he annulled the peace pact that Israel had forced him into. He was not a particularly strong leader. He lacked the charisma and aggression of his brother, as well as the ability or desire to drive all the Palestinians out of Lebanon. Sharon's plans to kill Yasser Arafat, however, never faltered for a second. After the battles in Beirut were over and the PLO leaders and forces had been evacuated from Beirut, "Arik and Raful Eitan were dying, simply dying, to kill him," said then Brigadier General Amos Gilboa, head of Amman's research division. Sharon realized that by this point, Arafat was such a popular figure that an open assassination would only make him a martyr to his cause. So he instructed the intelligence organizations to intensify their surveillance of Arafat and to see if they could find a more subtle way to dispose of him. Operation Saltfish morphed into Operation Goldfish, but the mission remained the same, and Sharon ordered that it be given top priority. Every day, and sometimes twice a day, the Goldfish team gathered in Eitan's office. "We had 1,000 matters that were 100 times more important," said Gilboa. But Sharon insisted. At that time, any intelligence about the PLO leaders' movements was partial at best. Wartime isn't an ideal place to gather information, and because the PLO had not yet found a permanent base to replace the one in Beirut, its officials and militiamen were moving constantly, living out of suitcases all over the Middle East and Europe. Arafat was traveling frenetically, meeting leaders, mobilizing support, giving interviews, and shifting funds around. When someone's on that kind of routine, and yet under heavy protection, it's hard for us to plan a hit operation against him, one of Caesarea's intelligence officers told the Goldfish Forum. The Mossad told Sharon that under these circumstances, it was impossible for them to get to Arafat. At best, they could report on his whereabouts in whatever country he was visiting that day, or whatever flight he was on the next. Amman told the defense minister that Arafat often used an executive jet provided by Saudi Arabia, and that the two pilots were carrying American passports. There was no question of shooting it down. "Nobody," said Amman's Amos Gilad, "touches Americans." The bottom line was that Amman saw no possibility of assassinating him at that time. "We have to wait until he settles down in a permanent place," said an Amman representative at the Goldfish Forum, "and then to begin planning an operation there." But Sharon was in a hurry, and Arafat sometimes used other private aircraft, too. Occasionally, he even flew commercial. To Sharon's thinking, blowing an aircraft out of the sky, especially over deep water where the wreckage would be hard to find, was a perfectly acceptable way to deal with the issue. The next problem was how to be sure Arafat was on a certain flight. General Gilboa demanded that a number of operational steps be taken in order to ascertain whether he was. "From my point of view, it would be positive identification only if we could prepare in advance, before his arrival at an airport, and have someone there standing at the door to the plane to tell us, 'That's him. I saw him with my own eyes.' Then I could say the bells are ringing," an intelligence phrase meaning near total certainty. Once the basics of the plan were settled, Sharon pushed hard to get the mission rolling. He instructed Air Force Commander General Ivry to keep fighter planes ready to intercept Arafat's aircraft. Ivry grasped the potential for disaster in such an operation, and once again informed Chief of Staff Eitan that he was not prepared to take orders directly from Sharon, and that IDF regulations required that all orders come via the Operations Directorate of the General Staff. This was not much of an obstacle for Sharon, and the orders that soon came down through the proper channels were largely the same, although words such as shoot down, destroy, and eliminate had been omitted. Finally, they found their opening in Greece. Arafat occasionally flew through Athens with the consent of the locals. The Greek authorities did not take rigorous measures against terrorism, says Admoni, and the PLO did more or less whatever it wanted to there. On October 22, 1982, two junction agents reported that Arafat would take off the next day in a private plane from Athens to Cairo. The Mossad immediately dispatched two Caesarea operatives to find out more details. The two operatives took advantage of lax security at the Athens airport and reached the area where private planes were parked, looking for Arafat. Back in Tel Aviv, Sharon kept up constant pressure for the operation to move ahead. The Air Force put two F-15 fighters on alert for immediate takeoff from the Tel Nof Air Force Base, southeast of Tel Aviv, but Ivry, ever cautious, briefed the airman himself. He understood the stakes. It was clear to him how disastrous it would be if Israel shot down the wrong aircraft. "You don't fire without my okay," he told the fighter crews. "Clear? Even if there's a communications problem, if you don't hear my order," he emphasized that part, "hear my order, you don't open fire." At 2 p.m., one of the Caesarea operatives in Athens called Mossad headquarters and said, "He's here. Positive ID." His excitement was audible. He reported that he had watched the PLO leader and his men making final preparations to board a DHC-5 Buffalo, a Canadian-made twin-engine cargo plane, with a tail painted blue with brown marks and the registration number 1169. To Ivry, something seemed off. "I didn't get this whole story," he said. "It wasn't clear to me why Arafat would be flying to Cairo. According to intelligence, he had nothing to look for there at the time. And if he was going there, why in that kind of a cargo plane? Not at all dignified enough for a man of his status. I asked the Mossad to verify that he was the man." The two operatives insisted that they were certain. "The objective has grown a longer beard to mislead," they reported, but they reconfirmed their positive identification. At 4:30 p.m., they reported that the plane had taken off. Ivry was informed, as was Eitan, who ordered it shot down. Ivry told his pilots to take off. The Buffalo is a very slow aircraft, especially when compared with the F-15, but the flight path was some distance away over the Mediterranean, out of the range of Israeli radar. The jets took off and headed for the anticipated interception point, but at a certain distance from the Israeli coastline, they had to rely only on their onboard radar, with its limited range. Ivry still felt a pang of doubt. He told his aide to contact the Mossad and demand that they activate more means of making sure that Arafat was on the plane. He wasn't showing any emotion, as was usual with him, but we could see he was very worried, said one of his subordinates who was there. Ivry needed to buy time. He knew that pilots could be overeager, that sometimes they'll look for a reason to fire upon a target, interpreting a burst of radio static as an affirmative to shoot, for instance. He needed to calm, twitchy trigger fingers. "Hold your fire," he reminded his pilots over the radio. "If there's no radio contact, do not open fire." Sharon and Eitan weren't in the bunker, but Eitan kept on calling Ivry to find out what was happening and to see whether the order to shoot down the plane had been given. Ivry gave the same reply each time. "Raful, we do not yet have positive confirmation that it is him." This despite the fact that the Mossad had in fact already confirmed and then reconfirmed a positive identification. Separately, Ivry told Amman and the Mossad that the visual identification was insufficient and he demanded yet another cross-checked confirmation that Arafat was on the plane. The F-15's radar screens picked up the blip of the Buffalo, 370 miles into Mediterranean airspace. The fighters closed rapidly and flew tight circles around the lumbering target. They read the tail number, saw the blue and brown markings. They were positive they'd found the right plane. The lead pilot keyed his radio. "Do we have permission to engage?" Ivry, in the Canary bunker, knew that by all accounts the answer should be yes. His fighters had a positive visual ID and a clear shot in open skies over empty ocean. Their job, his job, was to eliminate targets, not select them. But Ivry's doubts overcame him. "Negative," he answered the fighter pilot on the radio. "I repeat, negative on opening fire." He was still stalling for time, but he knew he couldn't do so for much longer. His justification for delaying the attack, that he was waiting for additional information from the Mossad and Amman, was weakening in the face of a chief of staff directly demanding over the phone that he give the attack order. Ivry understood that if he didn't do so very soon, he would have to explain why to Eitan and, more troublingly, to Sharon. Tension was heightening in Canary. The minutes dragged on. And then, 5 minutes before 5 o'clock, only 25 minutes after the fighters took off, a phone jangled in Canary. It was the encrypted line connected directly to the Mossad. "Doubts have arisen," the voice on the line said with embarrassment. It was the same intelligence officer who'd previously confirmed that Arafat had been identified as he boarded the aircraft. The Mossad had other sources who insisted that Arafat had been nowhere near Greece, and that the man on the plane couldn't possibly be him. In the absence of another order, the pair of F-15s continued to circle the Buffalo. Ivry picked up the handset again and repeated his orders. "We're waiting for more information. Keep eyes on the target and wait." At 5:23, another report came in to Canary. Sources from the Mossad and Amman said the man on the Buffalo was Fatih Arafat, Yasser Arafat's younger brother. He was a physician and the founder of the Palestinian Red Crescent. On the plane with him were 30 wounded Palestinian children, some of them victims of the Sabra and Shatila massacre. Fatih Arafat was escorting them to Cairo for medical treatment. Ivry breathed a sigh of relief. He keyed the radio. "Turn around. They're coming home," he ordered. Even this near disaster, coming within one jittery pilot's finger of murdering a doctor and 30 wounded children, did not weaken Sharon's hand or dissuade him from the idea of targeting Arafat in the air. In fact, he became even more reckless. When the Mossad reported that Arafat was flying more commercial flights, with the PLO often buying up the entire first-class or business-class cabin for him and his aides, Sharon decided that one of those would make a legitimate target. He ordered Eitan, the Air Force, and the operations branch to come up with a plan to shoot down a civilian jetliner. Sharon sketched out the broad parameters. The flight would have to be shot down over the open sea, far from the coast, so that it would take investigators a long time to find the wreckage and establish whether it had been hit by a missile or had crashed due to engine failure. Deep water would be preferable, to make recovery even more difficult. Aviam Sela couldn't believe his ears. It was a direct and clear order from him. "Shoot the plane down," he said. "I had no problem with killing Arafat, who deserved to die, in my opinion. The problem was with shooting down a civilian airliner with innocent passengers aboard. That is a war crime." In contrast to his brutal image, Eitan was a very cautious man politically, and it was evident that he did not want to be involved in such an adventure, Sela said. But Sharon was so domineering that no one could stand up to him. The Air Force drew up a detailed plan to shoot down an airliner. Its representatives at the Goldfish Forum explained that they had chosen a precise spot on the commercial air route across the Mediterranean, one where there was no continuous radar coverage by any nation, and where the sea below was a daunting 3 miles deep. A salvage operation there would be extremely difficult, perhaps impossible, with the technology of the time. This complex plan set strict parameters for where the Israeli aircraft could shoot down Arafat's plane undetected, which meant there would be a fairly narrow window of opportunity for executing the attack. Because the operation would take place far from Israeli airspace, beyond Israel's radar and radio range, the Air Force had to set up an airborne command post in the form of a Boeing 707 fitted with radar and communications equipment. Sela would command the operation from this aircraft. Under Sharon's direct orders, then, surveillance of Arafat was maintained continuously, and four F-16 and F-15 fighters at the Ramat David Air Force Base were placed on interception alert. Over the course of 9 weeks, from November 1982 to early January 1983, these planes scrambled at least 5 times to intercept and destroy airliners believed to be carrying Arafat, only to be called back soon after takeoff. General Gilboa expressed his sharp opposition to these operations time and again. "It was clear to me that the Air Force would execute it as well as could be, and the plane would vanish forever. They do what they are told, and if you give them an order to build a pipeline to move blood from Haifa to the Negev, they'll do it excellently and won't for a moment ask whose blood it is. But I had additional responsibility." As head of Amman Research, it was Gilboa's job to evaluate the political impact of each operation. "I told Chief of Staff Eitan that it could ruin the state internationally if it were known that we downed a civilian airliner." On one occasion, with a commercial plane believed to be carrying Arafat from Amman to Tunisia over the Mediterranean, and the Israeli jets closing in, Eitan asked Gilboa if he thought their target was definitely on the plane. The two were standing in the central space inside Canary. "Chief of Staff, do you really want to hear what I think?" said Gilboa. Eitan nodded. Gilboa could feel his heart thumping in his chest. He stalled, elaborating all the many reasons for believing Arafat might be on the plane, then enumerating all the many reasons to doubt he was on the plane. Eitan grew impatient. "Gilboa," he barked, "yes or no?" "My gut feeling," Gilboa said, "is that he isn't on the plane." Eitan turned around and went to the red encrypted phone at the side of the room. "Arik," he said to the defense minister, waiting impatiently in his office, "the answer's negative. We'll have to wait for another day." There is a lesson taught in IDF training, a lesson so important that the basics are mandatory for every recruit, and the details are a critical part of the officer training program as well. The lesson dates back to October 29, 1956, when an Israeli border police unit, ostensibly enforcing a curfew in the village of Kafir Qasim, rounded up a large group of residents as they were returning from work. Then they shot them. They killed 43 people, including 9 women and 17 children. The policemen claimed they were obeying an order to shoot curfew breakers, but Judge Benjamin Halevi, in one of Israel's most important judicial rulings, said that soldiers must not obey an order that is clearly illegal. "The distinguishing mark of a manifestly illegal order," Halevi wrote, "is that above such an order should fly like a black flag, a warning saying, prohibited. Not merely formally illegal, not covered up or partly covered, but an illegality that stabs the eye and infuriates the heart. If the eye is not blind, and the heart is not obtuse or corrupt." This lesson, ingrained in every soldier, was undoubtedly one of the only reasons that a war crime was not committed, despite the fact that on 5 different occasions, F-16 and F-15 fighters were called upon to intercept and destroy commercial airliners carrying Arafat. Indeed, the Air Force Command intentionally obstructed these operations, refusing to obey orders that they believed to be manifestly illegal. "When we received the order," Sela said, "I went with Ivri to see Eitan. I told him, 'Chief of Staff, we do not intend to carry this out. It simply will not happen. I understand that the Minister of Defense is dominant here. No one dares to stand up to him, and therefore we will make it technically impossible.' Raful looked at me and never said anything. I took his silence as consent. On each of the five occasions, Israeli planes identified their target over the sea, Sela said, but the mission was sabotaged. Once, the radios on the flying command post, the Air Force Boeing 707, were silenced by being set to the wrong frequencies, blacking out communications long enough to make the whole operation impossible. A second time, Gilboa determined at the last minute that there wasn't enough evidence that Arafat was on the target plane. A third time, Sela informed Eitan falsely that the target plane had been identified too late, and there was a danger that the interception would be detected by a nearby maritime nation. On the other occasions, we simply drew the time out until the plane had left the zones in which it would have been possible to hit them without discerning what had happened. In the end, though, Sharon's plans for an intentional war crime were finally derailed by his past unscrupulousness. Under intense pressure from the Israeli public and after heavy international criticism, Begin was compelled to establish a judicial inquiry into the massacre at the Beirut refugee camps. It was headed by the president of the Supreme Court, Justice Yitzhak Kahan, but the real force behind it was Aharon Barak, the opinionated and conscience-driven attorney general who had blocked the killing of the Nairobi terrorists and had since been appointed as a justice of the Supreme Court. For 3 months, the panel heard evidence from all the Israelis involved and pored over thousands of documents. This inquiry and its hearings made the first cracks in Sharon's monolithic power. After listening to Barak's penetrating questions, it didn't take long for the chiefs of the defense and intelligence communities to understand that their careers were also on the line. They quickly hired attorneys, who then instructed their clients to lay the blame at someone else's door. The commission soon became a spectacle of mutual recrimination. The Kahan Commission published its findings and recommendations on February 7, 1983. The Falange was found to be directly responsible for the massacre, but the commission ruled that some Israelis had to be held accountable as well. It is our opinion that a fear of a massacre in the camps if the Falange's armed forces were introduced there should have been aroused in anyone who had anything to do with what was happening in Beirut. The commission found that Prime Minister Begin had a certain degree of responsibility, but it placed most of the blame on Defense Minister Sharon, Chief of Staff Eitan, and Amman Chief Sagi, along with some other senior officers and Mossad Director Admoni. The commission recommended that Sharon be dismissed immediately. Sharon refused to resign, so Begin and his ministers fired him. Then, on September 15, 1983, Begin himself, stricken by anguish and sorrow, resigned the premiership and was replaced by Yitzhak Shamir. For the time being, the hunt for Arafat was called off. The fallout from Sharon's relentless hunt for him, and the enormous collateral damage that hunt created, had raised Arafat's stature even further. Arafat was now a man of international prominence and prestige. Much of the world now considered him a statesman rather than a simple terrorist. Gradually, Gilboa said, the awareness grew that Arafat was a political matter, and he must not be seen as a target for assassination. Of course, Gilboa continued, everyone under him in his organization was an entirely different matter. Chapter 17. The Shin Bet Coup. Traveling south from Tel Aviv to Ashkelon on Route 4, the driver moves along a 32-mile, two-lane major highway, the green Mediterranean scenery gradually giving way to sparser vegetation as the Negev Desert approaches. Route 4 runs parallel to the Mediterranean coastline, past the site of the ancient Philistine city of Ashdod, where the Israelis have built a new port city. Much of the sand dune scenery that once dominated the terrain is now developed, all the way down to the Gaza Strip. On April 12, 1984, at 6:20 p.m., a bus set out to Ashkelon from Tel Aviv's central terminus. There were 44 passengers, among them four Palestinians, sitting apart from one another and pretending not to know each other, concealing their nervousness as they prepared to hijack the bus to Gaza and take the passengers hostage. These were difficult days for Israel. The country was still licking its wounds from the war in Lebanon and still occupying part of that country. More and more soldiers were coming back in body bags, victims of the frequent clashes with guerrillas there. Inside Israel as well, violence reigned. On April 2, three terrorists from the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, who had entered Israel as tourists, opened fire with submachine guns and grenades in a busy street in central Jerusalem, wounding 48 people, one of whom died later. They were stopped only thanks to action taken by armed civilians. There were also acts of Jewish terrorism against Arabs. Right-wing extremists attacked Palestinian mayors, burned houses, and plotted to blow up five crowded buses. The Shin Bet caught them just before they carried out the latter attack. The four young Arab terrorists on bus 300 had been caught up in this maelstrom of violence. They were from the Khan Yunis area in Gaza. Their leader, 20-year-old Jamal Mahmoud Kabalan, was the oldest son in a family of 16. He had borne the burden of their livelihood since their father died, working as a dishwasher in various Tel Aviv restaurants. He had also served a year in an Israeli prison for minor terrorism infractions. His three companions were Mohammed Baraka, 19, and two cousins, Majdi and Subhi Abu Juma, both high school students less than 18 years old. Kabalan had persuaded them to join him in the hijacking, which he hoped would stir wide international resonance. But beyond their nationalistic zeal, they had no links with any organization, nor any firearms apart from a lone hand grenade. Instead, they carried knives, a bottle of yellowish liquid that looked as if it might be acid or some flammable substance, and an attaché case with some wires protruding, which was, in fact, nothing more than that, although they told their hostages it contained a bomb made up of two RPG rockets. 40 minutes out of Tel Aviv, when the bus reached the Ashdod junction, a passenger spotted the knife that one of the Arabs was carrying. He asked the driver to stop, pretending he was sick and wanted to throw up. As he got off the bus, he shouted, "Terrorists!" and jumped out. The four realized they had been made, and Kabalan ran to the driver, pressed his knife to his throat, and ordered him in Hebrew to go fast. The passenger who had gotten away called the police, who placed roadblocks along the bus's route, but the bus sped through all of them. It reached a spot near Deir al-Bala, in the center of the Gaza Strip, where security forces managed to puncture its tires and bring it to a stop against a stone wall. Some of the passengers were wounded by the gunfire, their shouts mingled with those of the other hostages and the hijackers. The driver jumped out and yelled to the passengers to do the same. Some succeeded, but then Kabalan closed the doors, and most were trapped inside. Soon the bus was surrounded by soldiers and special forces, as well as senior IDF officers and top Shin Bet personnel. The media also arrived in force at the scene, as did a swarm of curious onlookers. Kabalan shouted out that he would free the hostages only when 500 Palestinian prisoners were released from Israeli jails. Conducting the negotiation was the Shin Bet's senior expert on Arab affairs, Nachman Tal. He soon realized who he was dealing with. As he declared in a later testimony, "Right away I understood that they were not serious people, and they did not constitute a danger." Ehud Barak, then chief of military intelligence, got the impression that if the Shin Bet managed to draw out the negotiations for another few hours, the hijackers would agree to let the hostages go in exchange for some sandwiches. Nevertheless, the Israelis still felt that if it was possible to free all the hostages immediately using force, there should be no negotiations. At 4:43 a.m., the chief of staff, Lieutenant General Moshe Levy, who was on the scene, ordered Seiret Matkal to storm the bus. A sniper immediately took out Kabalan, who was standing at the front of the bus, and he fell dead onto the steering wheel, sounding the vehicle's horn. The Seiret fire also killed a young woman passenger. The soldiers also shot Baraka dead and found the Abu Juma cousins hiding among the passengers. At first, the commander of the Sayeret, Shai Avital, ordered that they be killed, but when he realized they were not dangerous, he rescinded the order immediately. Because, fuck it, I saw that from the moment the fighting was over, they were prisoners of war, and it was forbidden to kill them. The two were taken off the bus, and after a brief interrogation by Brigadier General Yitzhak Mordechai, the chief paratroop and infantry officer, to ascertain whether there were explosives or other terrorists on the bus, they were handed over to the Shin Bet, whose personnel were gathered together in a nearby wheat field. Micha Kubi, one of the Shin Bet's senior investigators, was questioning both of them, but the conditions weren't ideal. "I was trying to do things quietly," Kubi said, "but everyone there was in a frenzy." And then Avraham Avrum, Shalom, showed up. Shalom was the head of the Shin Bet, and had been for 4 years. The son of Austrian Jews who fled the Nazis, he joined the Palmach underground militia when he was 18. After the establishment of the state, he joined Shin Bet's operations unit. In the early 1960s, he collaborated with Yitzhak Shamir, then head of the Mossad's targeted killing unit, in Israel's efforts to stop the German scientists working on Egypt's missile program. The two became fast friends. When Menachem Begin resigned and Shamir became prime minister in 1983, Shalom became the most important person in the security establishment, said Carmi Gilon, who headed the Shin Bet in the 1990s. And I think that what happened to Avram was that he felt as if he could do whatever he wanted to do. Shalom ran the organization without constraints, and many of his subordinates considered him a manipulative and ruthless dictator. Toward Avram there was no awe, said Yuval Diskin, an operative under Shalom who, 20 years later, would be head of the agency. There was fear. We feared him. He was a strong man, brutal, clever, very stubborn, uncompromising, and an ass-kicker. As soon as the storming of the bus was over, Shalom had consulted with Chief of Staff Levy before joining his men in the wheat field. Avram Shalom was holding a pistol, Kubi said, and he brought its butt down with all his strength on the head of one of the terrorists. I saw the butt actually entering the skull. He was in a frenzy, said another Shin Bet man. Kubi announced that he wasn't prepared to carry on in the commotion going on at the scene, and demanded that the prisoners be moved to the Shin Bet's interrogation facility in Gaza. Members of the agency's operations unit, the Birds, who were guarding the two prisoners, took them out of the field. Shalom signaled to the unit's commander, Ehud Yatom, to come aside with him, and he quietly told him, "Finish them off." Shalom didn't want terrorists tried in a court of law. Allowing men who hijacked a bus to receive a proper trial, he believed, would only encourage more terrorism. Still, two criminals couldn't be summarily executed on a public highway, in full view of soldiers, reporters, and civilians. So Yatom and his team drove the two to an empty and isolated field a few miles away. Subhi and Majdi, battered and dazed by the night's events, were taken off the vehicle and made to lie on the ground. Yatom explained to three others what had to be done, picked up a large rock, and brought it forcefully down on Majdi's head. The others joined in. They beat them to death with rocks and iron bars, a brutal method chosen so that it would appear the two were murdered by enraged, renegade, and unidentifiable soldiers and civilians immediately after the raid on the bus. Kubi was waiting at the Gaza interrogation facility when he was informed that the terrorists had died on the way, from the beating they had supposedly received from civilians and soldiers. I realized exactly what had happened, Kubi said. Avram's policy was that terrorists carrying out an attack should not end up alive. I wasn't surprised when they told me that they wouldn't be coming in for questioning. I went home to bed. I thought that the whole thing was over and done with. Kubi thought that because such incidents typically were over and done with as soon as the bodies were cold. Over the years, as terror attacks multiplied, public pressure increased on the government and armed forces to adopt stricter counterterror measures. As Israel's responses intensified, however, the checks and controls over those responses gradually weakened. Targeted killing, which had once been practiced sparingly, far from the country's borders, and been subject to high-level authorization, had begun to be used much more frequently, much closer to home, and with far less supervision. The isolated irregularities perpetrated by a few unscrupulous units during and after the Six-Day War, for instance, had become an accepted practice by the mid-1970s, albeit one of dubious legality. The Shin Bet, which was responsible for thwarting PLO attacks in the occupied territories, had used illegal tactics since the 1960s. Shin Bet interrogators feared, not without cause, that if they did not squeeze information out of their captured prisoners, more Israelis would be killed. What began as intimidation and humiliation during interrogations evolved into outright physical and psychological torture. Mock executions, sleep deprivation, forcing prisoners to endure painful stress positions and extremes of heat and cold. Prisoners were sometimes administered supposed truth serums that, the subjects were told, caused impotency. The dark and filthy basement rooms where the Shin Bet carried out its interrogations took on such a sinister character that even a normal person who crossed that threshold would be prepared to confess to killing Jesus, said Gilon. Even Avraham Shalom said he was shocked by what he saw when he visited the Hebron detention facility as head of the birds and witnessed the grilling of an Arab who in my eyes was elderly. He was 55 then, the Arab, but looked much older. And our guy, who knew Arabic, was shouting at him, "Why are you lying?" The Arab was dilapidated, old, wretched, and I began to feel sorry for him. I asked, "Why is he shouting at him?" And finally, the interrogator took a chair, and he broke the chair on the floor, took one of the legs of the chair, and smashed his hand. He said, "Put your hand on the table." And he smashed all of his fingers. On another occasion, said Shalom, I saw an interrogator kill an Arab, not with blows. He flung him from one wall to another, from wall to wall, wall to wall. Then he took his head and almost broke the wall with that Arab's head. A week later, the Arab died from a cerebral hemorrhage. It was blurred over. Some prisoners died while being tortured, and some were driven to suicide. In other cases, PLO activists who were detained for questioning were found dead without even reaching a detention facility. Every now and again, a PLO activist would simply disappear. Their families would suspect they were in Israeli custody, and they would ask the police for assistance. The police would then publish a photograph of the missing person in a newspaper, standard procedure in such cases, and they would ask the Shin Bet if they had any information. We used to have a fixed formula then, said Yossi Ginosar, a senior Shin Bet official. It went, "There is no information in the security establishment as to the whereabouts of this person." This is what we told the police every time they asked us, although we knew very well what hole he was buried in. Some of those disappeared people were killed as part of the secret program codenamed Waits. In one Waits operation, Abu Jihad had his men smuggle large amounts of weaponry into the occupied territories, which were stored in caches until other Palestinian operatives could deliver them to attack squads. Sometimes the Shin Bet discovered the location of the cache, placed it under surveillance, waited for the pickup team to arrive, and captured them. On multiple occasions, however, the Shin Bet rigged the caches with powerful explosives, which would be remotely detonated when the pickup squads showed up. The basic idea behind Waits, said a Shin Bet source, was taken from the concept imported from the Israeli military activity in Lebanon, which said that there are times when it's not worthwhile to take prisoners. Doing that is both a greater risk for our forces, and also makes the other side want to take hostages for bartering exchanges. And in any case, they deserve to die. The way we saw things then, whoever came to a weapons cache to take the arms and use them to kill Jews, it's better if they have a work accident. Waits operations,